For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment on SDPB Radio. South Dakotans have drastically changed the way we live, all in an effort to slow the spread of the coronavirus. As the situation unfolds, you can find all SDPB's coronavirus coverage at sdpb.org/COVID. Here are some highlights from this week. On Monday, March 16th, Dr. Dan Heineman, Chief Medical Officer for Sanford Health Network, gave us the latest. Dr. Heineman, thanks for coming back.
Good morning. Yes, well, thank you for having us.
Let's start with the update from over the weekend as Sanford continues preparations for coronavirus in South Dakota. What can you tell us that has changed over the weekend or updated?
Well, we are continuing to update some recommendations and guidance to our staffs regarding the use of and saving personal protective equipment in terms of to make sure that we're good stewards of the resources that we have. So we're constantly sending new direction to our clinics throughout our entirety of our enterprise on our four states that we work with and within to make sure that they understand how to use that, how to clean rooms, how to screen patients, and we're changing our testing a little bit. And then trying to help our staffs keep up with the changes that are coming from the Centers for Disease Control, which is where we get all of our information, and we call it our one source of truth. So making sure that we get that information out to our clinics and hospitals. And our incident commands have been open. Our enterprise incident command has been open. And each market or each big hospital market and in our network, we also had our incident command up this weekend, and we're in touch with our practices and our clinics and our small hospitals.
Because this affects everyone in your system from the employee standpoint, housekeeping and food service, as well as emergency room doctors and clinic providers. It's quite an endeavor.
Correct. We need everybody to stay healthy. And we need everybody to help us, from the environmental services workers who help clean our rooms, to our laundry personnel, to our lab personnel, to our doctors, our nurses, you name it. We need to make sure that we can keep everybody healthy and at work.
You mentioned changing testing. How so?
Well, it's up until middle of last week, the only way you could get a test was to go through your state health department. But as part of this whole testing initiative across the country now, there are some private labs Quest and some others that are now coming online to be able to do the test. We actually hope in the short term to be able to do that test right within Sanford's labs. But there's a requirement that you get certified, that the federal government needs to make and steps in to make sure that that the tests that are done are accurate and have followed the lab standards, if you will. So on the weekend, going into the weekend and now coming out of the weekend, we can choose to send our tests in two directions. We can still send our tests to our state lab partners, as well as we now have an option to send our tests to a Quest which is a large lab partner that we've partnered with to send our tests to maybe get a little better and faster turnaround time.
So talk to us about the process now today, and I understand it's a very fluid situation, but for testing for people in South Dakota or in the Sanford system somewhere, who should get tested? How do they get tested? Let's start with, who do you want to be tested now?
Well, we would encourage, in fact, require everybody who has a concern about whether or not they should be tested to begin the process by contacting their primary care clinic provider. When they make that contact to their usual source of primary care or their usual source of care, there will be a series of screening questions that will be asked of the individual to identify what their risk is and whether or not they are in that risk category that should be tested, because we still have to be careful about how many tests that we provide. So if you answer the travel questions, you answer the symptom questions, and you answer the exposure questions in a way that would put you in a higher risk category, you will then be said we should test you. And I should also add, if you're not ill, if you're seriously ill, we're not going to just send you to a testing location, but we're going to ask you to go to your doctor. And then we need, and we want that prior knowledge that you'll be coming, so that when you arrive at that clinic location, you can be properly masked, taken back to an exam area, that our staff can be properly protected so that we can minimize the exposure to folks in the clinic as well as staff in the clinic. So if you're deemed high risk and needing testing, but not ill enough to be seen, we have opened in Sioux Falls a drive-up testing location where you will be sent, and then the orders will be placed. You will be then sent to this area. A sample will be collected, sent off, and then it generally we get some results back in 1 to 2 days. If it's a serious, if the patient is ill, then we may ask that individual to self-isolate or stay at home. So it really does need to start with an assessment by the nurses and our clinicians, physicians, nurse practitioners, and PAs in our clinic locations. In the sites outside of Sioux Falls, you may be directed to go to a site that has been set up either at a clinic or at a local hospital where that sample can be obtained and then sent off for evaluation and testing.
For those people who do not have a primary care doctor, either because they're uninsured or they only see a specialist because they have a chronic health condition, who should they call?
They can call our one call number, which is 333-4455. And their nurses and infection prevention specialists will help them identify. They can do those screening questions. They can get that testing done. They can also make arrangements for them to be seen, if need be, by either one of our acute care locations and or make an appointment at our closest primary care clinics. It really starts with that those questions that determine whether or not an individual is at high risk. Should also add that testing is of no, there is no charge for the testing. So people should not avoid getting properly evaluated because they have a concern about whether or not this will get covered or paid for. Many insurance plans are waiving copays, waiving a variety of financial barriers. We want to make sure that we're getting our communities adequately screened and taken care of. And so please, please don't let whether or not you have insurance coverage and or a way to pay for it stand in the way of getting properly tested because or properly evaluated and tested if necessary.
I can imagine some people in rural South Dakota are saying, you know, what if I have symptoms and do I bother driving to a testing site to get tested, or should I just care for myself at home because that's what you're going to tell me to do anyway? Is it important to get to reach out and be evaluated for testing if you have symptoms or if you're in one of those travel risk categories or exposure risk categories?
Well, the other thing that testing can help us with is, remember, we're still in influenza season, and a vast number of patients who think they have this respiratory virus or the COVID-19 what we're finding is they have influenza. They can use their best judgment. If they believe that they are just dealing with a common variety upper respiratory infection, nothing is getting worse for them, staying at home, treating themselves at home with symptomatic care is appropriate. If, however, they begin to worsen, then they should be seeking out at least some phone consultation, evaluation to make sure that there is not a reason for them to be seen and seen early to make sure that we understand what's going on. And then also, if they did have this COVID-19, we would like to know so that we can then reduce and mitigate the exposures that they may have had to other individuals, either at home or in their communities as they've been out and about.
As people are getting symptoms, whether it's an influenza symptoms or a scratchy throat from talking about this too much, for example, there's a certain amount of fear that's going on because of the thoughts of people being ventilated. What if that happens to someone I love? When do people know that they need to seek emergency care and make that phone call? Once they have, what do you know about the people who are sick? When is it an emergency? Because the flu can feel awfully, you know, you can feel pretty desperate and out of it when you have the flu and you're running a very high temperature. When do you make an emergency call and seek emergency care?
Typically, influenza makes you feel miserable. You'll have a bad cough. You may get short of breath. But from what we understand about this particular virus is that it does tend to make people more short of breath. So if you've had a fever and you've had some aches, and you've bad cough, but you don't get significantly short of breath, or you don't have any other complicating medical conditions like heart disease, lung disease, et cetera, then you can stay home. But I'd say if you start to get more short of breath, you definitely need to be making contact with a healthcare provider so that they can assess your situation and recommend what might be the most appropriate care. And it also depends on your age. If you're older, you need to probably make those phone calls sooner. If you're older and have complicating things like diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, even sooner. And so, and that's not to say that if you're young and don't have those complicating illnesses, you shouldn't be at least making a call to find out if you need to be more concerned.
Tell us how Samford is working with state government or federal government officials to prepare for that potential influx of patients. We've heard a lot about the number of intensive care beds and the accessibility of personal protective equipment for staff and ventilators or respirators. What is that process? What can you tell us about what that process looks like? Are you getting the response from the federal and state government that that you need?
Yes. For quite some time, Samford has had an emerging threats group that's been meeting now for probably about 6 weeks. The last week and a half, we've opened up our incident command center. So there's an incident command center for the entirety of Samford. And then each region has its own incident command. We've been working with, we've been working very well with the governors of our states, with the emergency preparedness people in our states, our state's departments of health. Believe it or not, now our state's departments of education. In other words, as states begin to start talking about canceling schools, what's best. And so our leadership at our corporate level has almost daily interaction with those governmental agencies, both local, state, and federal, as we get ready, as we look for materials, as we plan for the worst case scenario, but hope that we never get there because we do such a good job in the early aspects of, so you know, the best way to prevent this illness from taking over our immediate area is social isolation, staying home, minimizing exposure, and then if and when you need help, seeking it by calling first, and then we'll help people to get the necessary care that we need, that they need, and that we can provide in a safe way so we don't overwhelm our healthcare system.
Right. And to recap, people are washing their hands. You can call that Samford one call number if you don't have a primary care doctor, if you don't have insurance, and that's 333-4455. The South Dakota Department of Health website is covid.sd.gov. You can reach out for all kinds of information for how to take care of things in your home. It has links to the CDC sites as well. And Dr. Anthony Fauci says said on the news shows this weekend, Dr. Heineman, that if it looks like you're overreacting, you're doing it right. When we talk about people who are still thinking, this is not relevant to me, I'm healthy, I'm young, I don't have a condition, or it's not that big of a deal. If it looks like you're overreacting, you're doing it right. Do you agree with that assessment from Dr. Fauci?
Absolutely. We need to remember that we shouldn't act selfishly. Yes, I may feel well. I don't see why I have to stay home. But this is all of us coming together to do the best for those who cannot necessarily survive or would not necessarily come out of this in the best. And we know, like our long-term care elderly residents in our long-term care facility, the elderly residents in our communities. So we all need to take this seriously and not be selfish in our activities and our actions.
Santos, welcome back. Thanks
for being here. The Federal Reserve acted aggressively over
the
weekend, slashing interest rates to near
zero.
Lots
happened over the weekend.
And this is something that you and I were talking about.
Joe Santos is a professor of macroeconomics
and Dyke House scholar of money, banking, and regulation.
Let's start with the Federal Reserve and the action taken over the weekend. President Trump was getting up.
You can find his ongoing macroeconomics lessons on his website,
school.blog.com.
Here he is on Monday, March 16th.
Satisfaction with that news. Tell people what happened if they're just tuning in now to that announcement, and then let's talk about what it means.
Sure. So this was very much a monetary policy action. Again, going back to your reference, the tools in the shed, this was the monetary policy tool. So this was the Federal Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve System meeting in an unscheduled way for the second time now. The first time was on March 3rd, that is recently. Meeting to decide whether or not to change their federal funds rate target. And so they met and they agreed to change the target. They lowered it. It's a range. Now this federal funds rate target is between 0 and 0.25%. So this was a full 1 percentage point drop yesterday evening after an unscheduled Federal Open Market Committee meeting. So this was quite unprecedented. The Fed acted in order to, as they like to say, unclog these short-term credit markets. And we could talk a bit about that some more if you'd like. But as far as the interest rate cut goes, it was a very drastic form of an otherwise conventional monetary policy, that is, using the federal funds rate. That's the rate that banks charge one another for reserves, think inventories, essentially. And so using that rate as an instrument of policy, again, except this time in a very dramatic fashion, lowering the range by a full 1 percentage point after an unscheduled meeting.
So the president seemed enthusiastic to me about that, almost it's about time. That's great news. And others, I was listening to Marketplace on NPR this morning, and there was also this sense that it can convey something that says, hey, we're really worried about this, and can cause other concerns too. What's the balance between acting decisively in an unprecedented fashion and then saying, yeah, we're, I think the analogy they used was, if you see a bunch of fire trucks going somewhere, part of you says, oh, good, they're going to put out the fire. And part of you says, holy cow, that's a really big fire. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Can I have that? That was really good.
It was on Marketplace. Yeah. I didn't make it up. Yeah.
That's right. So when you see something so unprecedented, on the one hand, you think they are really acting. And to your point, on the other, you think, gosh, how bad is bad? I think the move was appropriate. That is to say, lowering interest rates in dramatic fashion sooner rather than later. Later would have been waiting for just a few days, beginning tomorrow, when they would have their scheduled meeting. But acting in this way was a sort of monetary policy show of force. It also had some technical features to it. This is a little bit deep in the weeds, but the credit markets were behaving very oddly in the last week. And one feature that we were observing that was quite concerning was that there were certain relationships between various kinds of financial assets that were behaving in ways that we wouldn't expect. So, for example, when stock prices were going down for a little bit, so were bond prices. Typically, what you see is stock prices go down and everybody rushes to the exit, and the exit is really U.S. Treasury bonds. And so this flight to safety usually causes a negative correlation between stock prices and bond prices. Well, last week, both of those prices briefly went down. And that suggested that the markets did not have the necessary liquidity. And so this is very technical, but that's really what the Federal Reserve, I think, was trying to do more than is trying to do more than anything else, is unclog these credit markets, which can be very, we say, segmented, sort of little corners where you don't have the necessary liquidity. And so you get these very odd behaviors in terms of the market prices and yields. So they have been going in there to try to surgically address these corners of what we would call illiquidity. And I think that was exactly the thing to do. This sort of plays out, as I said, as very conventional monetary policy where the Fed lowered rates on Sunday. I don't know that they were thinking so much that they wanted to lower rates for the conventional reasons of stimulating spending and so on and so forth, at least not at this moment while we're all sort of self-quarantining, but more, again, to approach a very technical aspect of the markets, which was to unclog certain credit markets. So what they announced was they will be buying now large quantities of treasury bonds, but also large quantities of other so-called mortgage-backed securities. The idea is to get liquidity into these corners of the credit markets that seem to have dried up, and certainly because of anxiety and other concerns, and as a result has led to a sort of a dysfunctionality in the credit market. So I think that very technical aspect is their primary concern. But in the process of doing that, when you pour that much liquidity into the market, you do also bring interest rates dramatically lower. And so that was, of course, the result as well.
We also heard a lot about, payroll tax breaks and other mm-hmm. things coming through Congress. And I think we even heard that message from the Fed saying it's your turn to do your part, Congress, and the executive office of the president as well. What does that look like? What are we already seeing happen in efforts to sort of stop the economic panic and shore things up?
Sure. So we're seeing folks really come together on this notion that fiscal policy must now, you know, take the baton, if you will. As they say, you know, there are no atheists in foxholes. So, your principles be darned. Now it's time to deal with a potential macroeconomic contraction. And so monetary policy has sort of done all it can in a conventional sense. Now it's time for fiscal. And by fiscal policy, as most folks probably know, this is government taxing and government spending. So this is the purview, if you will, of the FISC or the Treasury. And the thinking now is that what we need to do is essentially inject potential spending into the household. As we know, the consumer is the largest percentage of gross domestic product spending. And so fiscal policy can do something monetary policy cannot. Monetary policy can lower the rates, but it's pushing on a string. The Fed can't make you borrow the money and spend it. Fiscal policy can inject spending capacity directly into the household. So in the way of payroll tax cuts. Some folks have said just very sort of simply send everybody $1,000. Now, the way that plays out in practice is a little complicated, but in principle, the idea is these folks have a propensity to consume if their income permits it. If you inject, if you will, those households with additional spending capacity, then they will sort of take that forward. And if nothing else, perhaps limit the reduction in economic activity that might otherwise occur when households try to, as we say, self-insure, absent any sort of fiscal injection, self-insure against the crisis, and in doing so, really sort of clam up and create all sorts of negative knock-on effects. So the idea is, inject spending capacity in the form of tax breaks, tax cuts, direct payments, what have you, to the households, and that will then allow the households to spend going forward. And, you know, the argument right now is, you sort of think of this from 50,000 feet, Treasury yields are very low, which means, in effect, the world is actively seeking to lend its money to the Treasury. And so this would be essentially the Treasury borrowing those funds and then putting them back into the households in ways that the market might not otherwise do. So that's the sort of principled argument for this kind of fiscal policy at this moment.
And that brings the question of, tax cuts don't pay for themselves. This kind of fiscal policy, so there's a bill to pay at some point, right? Mm-hmm.
There is. And two quick things. One, if there is going to be an effective policy, just a little bit of a tangent, this to your point, it's got to be big. So some of the numbers being thrown around, and of course, no one knows for sure. But the idea right now is some of the consensus estimates are perhaps in the current quarter, a 2% drop. And this is annual, not 2% for the quarter, but 2% on an annual basis of GDP, perhaps in the second quarter of 2020, a 3% drop annualized. So if you're talking about numbers like 3% of GDP, if that's what we're going to lose as a result of a contraction, well, then, very back of the envelope approximation, you'd want to inject, let's say, 3% of GDP into the economy. That's about $600 billion. So until folks are talking about B's, not M's, billions, not millions, and hundreds of billions, it's really not going to have the sort of force it would need to have in order to replace the kinds of economic losses that we're anticipating. Having said that, this then comes to your question of, yes, but there's going to be a bill to pay. Well, as we always say, we always think about the debt of the U.S. economy relative to GDP, the size of the U.S. economy. So in the case of the United States government, they do have a rather large outstanding debt. Quick, numbers, think $20 trillion. GDP is about $20 trillion. So it's about 100% the ratio of debt to GDP, certainly 80%, depending on how you measure it. So if we take on more debt in order to inject this potential spending into households, we're going to increase outstanding debt. But if what we end up doing is succeeding in maintaining GDP growth, then debt to GDP, the ratio that matters more than anything else, needn't rise substantially. So imagine we take on debt or we do nothing and GDP falls. Debt to GDP actually goes up and we didn't even incur additional debt, right? But GDP fell. So by taking on additional debt, if we could stop the fall in GDP or at least limit it, we could be in a better fiscal position than if we do nothing. So it takes a moment to think about that way. But again, right, ratios are what matter. So the additional debt, no question, it's arithmetic. We're going to take on additional debt, but we may also end up preserving the growth in GDP or at least limiting the loss in growth in GDP. The denominator, if you will, can be supported in ways that may leave us in actually potentially a better fiscal position than if we sit back and do nothing.
So you mentioned injecting, helping households, rebound and do that consumer spending. How much is that complicated by the fact that households can't leave the household right now? And so many of us really need to stay home. And that's not going to get better in a week.
It's not going to get better in the week, but we're not going to get that money to the household in a week either. So talking about it now, setting up the infrastructure now, determining how we can use the current infrastructure, as easy as it's actually not very easy to send every household $1,000 if that's what we decide to do. That is, technically speaking, that's much easier said than done. So there are various ways you can do this. Some folks have argued, for example, changing withholding tax tables in a very sort of blunt way so that there's an enormous payment to households sooner rather than later. But the point is, we need to plan this now so that, hopefully when this pandemic passes rather quickly, that is, hopefully it's quick, it will pass, but hopefully it's quick, then, if you will, the potential spending is there and ready to go. So even if households can't leave their houses, they've got the confidence to know that this is on the way. That can help. And then ultimately, when they can leave their homes, they've got the financial wherewithal in order to act in a way that can limit the loss of economic activity. But your point's well taken. You're not going to do very much with it at the moment, but it certainly can't hurt. And then once you can act on it, the hope is that that would stimulate the economy. And some of these estimates, the very same folks, JP Morgan Chase and other private estimates that say GDP could fall for a quarter or two at an annualized rate of 3%, also argue that then we can have a rather quick expansion out of this if we see something on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars of fiscal injections into the economy.
So it's very similar to this idea of social distancing right now, testing right now to avoid overwhelming the healthcare system. We prepare now, and then we'll be ready to mitigate this whole thing in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, that's right. Because as this economic activity is lost, you know, there are what economists call deadweight losses. There's something, a transaction you and I were about to engage in. It would have been mutually beneficial, and it doesn't happen. If enough of that sort of deadweight loss is incurred, that will really deteriorate the economy. Jobs will be lost, and there simply will be effects that will be very difficult to repair. The sooner you can act and really not let any of that actually happen, the better. So that's the argument for speed, as you said, and it's in many ways analogous to the argument for speed in the epidemiological context.
Dr. Post, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laurie. Happy to be here.
A lot changed over the weekend, but it's all part of the ongoing planning at Avera. Tell us a little bit about what's new this Monday that
medical systems in the state are coordinating with state government, federal government, and each other.
But each one also develops their own coronavirus plan. Dr. Kevin Post is chief medical officer with Avera Medical Group. We spoke with him on Monday, March 16th.
So that we can serve our workforce, our personal protective equipment, also possibly limiting procedures so that we have enough intensive care beds, ventilators available for the sick patients should that occur. So at this point, we're not completely limiting all of those activities, but we are just developing a strategy of how our operations would work should this worsen.
And that's pretty much in guidance with the CDC and what we're hearing as being asked of hospitals across the nation. How is Avera working with state government and federal government on those preparations, especially when it comes to capacity issues?
Yes, very closely. So more locally and on a state level, we have been working with the governor, the different health systems within the state, as well as the State Department of Health to have a consistent policy as we move forward, for sure when it does come to triaging patients, bed availability, should it lead to that. So on a national level, we follow very closely what the CDC or the Center for Disease Control does use for recommendations, and we try to follow them closely as well.
Do you feel like you're getting what you need from the federal government and the state government?
Yes. As far as we've been very happy with the response from them. This, of course, is a very fluid situation, so things change rapidly. What we were doing 2 days ago may be slightly different now today because of the progression of the outbreak. However, we do overall feel fairly satisfied with both our national and statewide cooperation.
One of the concerns that we're hearing a lot from listeners, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the process for testing and a treatment if you have symptoms or if you have a confirmed case of COVID-19. What we're hearing is a lot of people who want to be tested and can't. We saw the state numbers released now with negative, 494 cases have been negative, 10 are positive across the state. But there's zero pending right now, which would possibly lead for people to infer that a lot of people people who have symptoms aren't getting the tests they need. So let's talk about process for testing. Where do you want to begin there?
Yeah, so the process for testing is, which we developed a guideline for that as well, is basically a set of questions that we ask patients to see if they qualify. There's initial three sets of questions that has to do with the onset of fever, cough, or new respiratory symptoms. And then out of them three questions, if you screen positive for one of those, you move on to a second set of three questions that is based more about on your personal risk factors or if you've traveled to a high-risk area. Based on those, if you screen positive, that will place you in a, based on how you screen there, you'll be placed in a low, moderate, or high risk category. And from there, we direct patients onward on the moderate high risk category to a testing center. And that's how we kind of determine how we ration out who can have the test so that we keep enough of the test available should the need arise to test those people that meet the criteria to be more likely to have the condition.
You said rationing out tests, and we were listening to the president say that these tests are available to anybody who wants them. Help reconcile those two statements for me, please.
All right. So there are enough tests available for those who do meet the criteria. Our concern is if you just randomly start testing people that don't meet the criteria, that at some point we may run short on supplies of the test. The other concern is when you do start screening people that do not meet the criteria, then what happens is you may end up having some false positives as well, which is absolutely what you do not want in this situation.
Explain that more, false positives.
So a false positive is when you run a test on a patient and it comes back positive, but all tests have a small degree of error to them. So if you started running too large of a volume on tests on patients that did not qualify, eventually you may have some positive tests that aren't a true positive, which you don't have a great way of sorting out. So
okay, and is that something that we don't really know about coronavirus yet, but we know about influenza or other viruses? Is that part of this being a novel coronavirus, or is that standard concern?
That is fairly standard when it comes to testing. Yep.
All right. So for people, and I'm not saying this has happened at Avera because I don't know the answer to that question, but for people who are saying, hey, I have a fever and I have a cough and I called the number that I was supposed to call and I was told I don't qualify for a test, can you tell people like what might be going on there?
Hypothetically, I would say if the health system functions like Avera is, hypothetically, based on what their symptoms were, they possibly did not meet the criteria for the test. And that's if the questions were directed. Now, to be honest, not all health systems are handling all of this in identical ways. So
sure.
Depending on which health system you're called, the process may be slightly different. So I cannot speak for all those health systems.
Right. So. Fair enough. And you mentioned testing centers. How is Avera expanding their testing centers? What are Avera patients facing when it comes to, hey, it's time for you to get tested, where are they going?
Yep. So with our call-in number, when you do qualify to be sent for testing, then we do have testing centers located in Sioux Falls and then throughout our regional sites. And we then direct the patient to the nearest testing center by them, and then they go there in for the process of being tested. And following them being tested, they then go home and they are asked to kind of self-quarantine or stay out for approximately 3 days or until the test results are available. In the meantime, of course, do the basic things of proper hand hygiene, washing, social distancing, where you're keeping yourself away from your loved ones and of course, not going out in public until you know if you are positive or not.
Are you implementing drive-through testing, expansion of testing services? What does that look like for Avera's plan?
Yes, so Avera does have some drive-through testing sites, but to access those sites, you have to screen positive to be tested. You can't just show up at a drive-through site and be tested. So you still need to go through the possible process of calling in the Avera line to make sure you qualify to be tested. What we do not want is a rush of patients going to a testing site, expecting to just be able to drive through and get the test without meeting criteria.
Right. One of the names of this game is that everybody has to stay informed and stay calm and think of their neighbors, because there are situations here where we've seen people stockpiling, and same thing, a testing site could be overwhelmed by people who are not on the schedule to be there. We really need to be paying attention to that. Tell me a little bit about the testing itself and what labs you're working with to get those test results back.
Right now, the tests are mainly being ran at the South Dakota Department of Health. So through that is where the primary the test results are coming back now. Now nationwide and even locally with our systems, we are looking at other testing options. If this does become more of a larger case volume, can there be more lab sites available that can run the test, both for quicker turnaround time and as to not overwhelm the state lab? But of course, you have to meet certain criteria before you can be certified to do that.
And again, important to note that that's all changing day by day as well. For people who have, we mentioned sort of clearing the decks of elective surgeries and things that can wait, people are being asked for those things to be postponed in a reasonable way. For people who have chronic conditions, that they're normally, you know, the cancer patients, the asthma patients who just need a refill of medication, somebody who's, you know, broken a hand or something, how are those patients getting the healthcare services that they need right now? And are you recommending any changes to how they sort of contact their providers?
Yes, that's a very important question because that is, you're exactly right. The standard medical care of all the other conditions needs to go on. So what we are doing is, you know, hopefully triaging our patients as they come in, and those with the coronavirus symptoms, we will try to quickly triage them off-site if they are stable enough to hopefully keep our clinics as healthy and disease-free as possible. Because you're right, the other patients do need to be seen. So what I think those patients with high-risk conditions should do is contact their primary care provider's office prior to coming in to make sure that it is an appropriate appointment it needs to be done, or whether it can be triaged and done over the phone. And then following that, the provider will give them education on where they can best be seen.
Avera is known for their e-care services, and we heard the president over the weekend talking about removing regulations or trying to help telehealth move forward in a more aggressive way. Are you seeing any potential there for expanding e-care services? It seems Avera was pretty poised in the marketplace to respond to that. What do you know?
Yes, and I do think this is a great opportunity for Avera to help out with our telehealth experience and expertise. In fact, as recently as this morning, we were in meetings discussing how we can, for sure with the government regulations being lifted, how we can advance our services there. That really offers a lot of things. We can use our providers at different locations to service throughout our entire network. It also avoids contacts for both the patients and the providers, and I definitely see it as an opportunity where we can make care more accessible for the public.
You mentioned a call-in number, and the next question is about people who don't have a primary care provider because they're uninsured, or they just haven't found a doctor yet because they didn't need one. What number should they call?
I do not have the Avera number right in front of me to call off the mine. What they would want to do is they could contact a primary provider if they have access to one, and we would be able to provide them with that number. I can pull it up here as we speak to help provide it with you. And I think I have it here. The phone number is 1-877-282-8372.
828-3-7-2. And you can find information at the State Department of Health at covid.sd.gov as well. There's a South Dakota COVID information hotline for the state of South Dakota as well, 800-997-2880. We're going to keep putting those numbers and contact information up on our website at listen.sdpb.org and at sdpb.org. Dr. Kevin Post, we really appreciate the update. Anything else that you wanted to make sure to tell people? Because one of the things we're talking about is how seriously to take this. And Dr. Anthony Fauci said over the weekend, if it looks like you're overreacting, you're doing it right. Do you agree with that statement?
Yes, and that's a common question. I completely agree with it. If I could have one thing I would like to bring to the public is that now is the time to be acting before we are in a severe situation where there are a lot of cases. What we do right now within the next week by staying calm, washing our hands, and especially doing the social distancing, and by that I mean staying away from large crowds, not going out when you don't need to, is what we can do to hopefully prevent a large surge of patients that would overwhelm the healthcare system.
Do you have confidence in the people?
It may seem too early, but yeah. It is not. It would be my plea. Yep.
Do you have confidence in the people of South Dakota that they're willing to unite and band together and do that? It seems like something that we're particularly poised to be able to do.
I do. I think we have great people in the Midwest, and I think we will come through.
All right. Thank you so much, Doctor. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Rocks, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
The fact that Dr. Rocks teaches at Mines,
South Dakota Board of Regents
is a pretty big
all
celebratory.
All public universities will move to online learning for at least 2 weeks,
right?
In light of public health concerns regarding coronavirus.
It's great to be at
Professor Elizabeth Rocks is an epidemiologist and public health expert.
Tell us a little bit about when you started talking
with
your students about the possibility of not only online learning, but the possibility of a global pandemic that could reach into our lives as well.
Well, we began talking to the students early about the potential pandemic and the complications from the newly named COVID-19 virus. We started back in February. We simply knew that we had to address this. I took time out of class, let the students ask me their questions. I turned class periods into question and answer sessions. And this allowed me to give them information about the new novel coronavirus, but also allay their fears a little bit if they were kind of wondering, hey, are we overreacting to this? They had questions about what is this virus? How is it different? Are these numbers inflated that we're hearing? And so it was a real chance for us to talk about critical thinking because their questions were leading them to critical thinking points. It's not just about this fact or that fact, but that they're asking the questions. They're asking, what does the data say? Not, is this case, are we overreacting in this case? Are we underreacting? But let's look at what the data says and make a response from there. I wanted my students to not just react. I wanted them to think about what they were being told. So we also covered different terminology. We covered vocab words, like what does isolate mean versus quarantine? Okay, so isolate is when you have it and you're staying isolated. When you're quarantined, it's the isolated group plus the group that we're exposed to or potentially exposed to the agent that we're talking about. So it was a real chance just to let the students get a picture of what's going on. For my more advanced biomedical physiology students, they really had a sobering moment that I noticed in the classroom when we started discussing the fact that they were the up-and-coming physicians, health workers, biomedical researchers, and that they would possibly have to deal with something like this in the future and be calling the shots.
Right.
That was very sobering for them.
Mm. And galvanizing in some ways, I would guess. If you know that you're in the right in the right field, if you sort of feel like you're ready to rise to that occasion in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One of the things and challenges we've seen is that young people, such as college students, are generally it's looking as if they're not as affected by this, and that has created certain challenges for behavior, especially as all this happened in the United States around spring break, and in the middle of a spring semester where some people were sent home, but not sent home right away in colleges across the state, so they had some opportunities to celebrate a little bit before they left campus. Some were already traveling. What has sort of have you kind of dealt with that impact of getting young people to think about why that would be and how they should behave?
Well, first, I think young people now, yes, we are seeing that the cases aren't impacting them as terribly as other age demographics. However, many students have, and many young people have underlying conditions, and they do need to be aware that that puts them at greater risk. As far as communicating with our students and talking with young people about the importance of washing your hands and taking these steps of self-quarantine, even though you may only have a mild case, the most effective approach that I have found is to remind them of the good they can do. Mm. Remind them that they are protecting grandparents and parents and other friends who who have underlying conditions. And that can be quite sobering.
Yeah. And this is also a huge challenge for professors and for students in a dance major, a chemistry major, students in the science. There's so much of college that really can't be done online, which is why we send people to college in the first place, not just from a social standpoint, but from an academic standpoint. How do these students, these future scientists and engineers and researchers, continue the rigorous coursework that they need to do at a time of disruption?
I think the first thing we need to do is remind them that we are working very hard to keep them on track academically, that the faculty, staff, the entire South Dakota Board of Regents system is trying to provide them a quality education and keep them on track. They will have some adjustments to make if their course was not online prior to the recent changes that we've had going out. There are some feelings of being overwhelmed, but I think we do just need to remind the students that we are working to get the classes online, get the material that they need online, and conduct the testing that they need to show us that they are learning. So we have tools as faculty. We have tools. We have software. We have the ability to put our lectures online, pre-recorded, so the students can listen to them. We will be making changes to the program. At least in my classes, I'm making some changes to my syllabus. I'm adding more worksheets. I'm adding more written essay so I can see that they're writing things out by hand. Because getting the information out, we have software programs that we use to communicate with the students already. We use D2L. We can use Zoom, regular email. So communication isn't a huge problem. It's more about, or the ability to communicate isn't a huge problem. It's more about communicating often enough, almost over-communicating here at first, so we know we're all on the same page and the students really are getting that quality information. And if they're not, then we just troubleshoot it and and keep working on it until they get it.
As an epidemiologist, as a public expert, public health expert, I'm sure you're also getting a lot of questions from friends and family and colleagues who are in different fields, and they're asking the same thing. Are we overreacting? Are we underreacting? What's your message?
I don't think that we're underreacting at this point. Overreacting, we need to pull out all the stops right now. That's not really the issue. If we look back with 2020 hindsight and say, oh, well, you know, we didn't use those extra ventilators that we organized, I think that we will be happy that we're at least looking back in hindsight and saying, well, we did the best we could. Maybe it was more than enough, but we've saved lives.
When you look back and your expertise at other, you know, much is being written about the Spanish flu or Ebola or other pandemics, other worldwide health challenges, public health challenges, are there useful comparisons? And did we learn from those previous events that gives us knowledge we can apply now?
I think we do need to look back at former outbreaks and pandemics. They do inform us on how to handle quarantine better. What are issues that might come up? How are those issues handled? Were they handled well? It may give doctors, physicians, or nurses on the ground interacting with patients who are very ill insights into how to treat them. We don't have our modern toolkit ready. We don't have our vaccine ready yet. We don't have our antivirals ready yet. So we do need to rely on the lessons learned from prior outbreaks.
State of South Dakota
has, those are the tools we can use.
Yeah. The state of South Dakota currently has 11 positive cases. 551 tests have come back negative. There are 35 tests pending. And we're being told by the State Department of Health that we don't have community spread of the disease at this time because all those cases are travel related. They can document those. We're anticipating those numbers are going to increase and increase maybe even at alarming rates based on what's happened in other communities. Is that what you're anticipating too?
I anticipate that we will certainly keep the numbers updated as best we can. I know the South Dakota Department of Health is tracking with testing as best they can. I think part of the scariest thing for me about the numbers that we're seeing is that we're not seeing all the numbers.
Right.
We know that this, when we have a person who's infected with this novel COVID-19 virus, that they can spread it to 2 to 3 people. And that multiplies very, very quickly out into the public. And I think this leads into issues with testing. We are going to, as we increase our testing, we are going to find more cases and we will see spikes. Now, if those spikes are overloading our healthcare system, that's when we're going to really run into problems. I think right now, as of about a week ago, the state had about 900 test kits. We've used, as you were saying, around 500 of those. There are more. It has been said that there are more that have been requested. I don't know the status on when those are arriving, but that is a major concern. We want to get a full picture of what's happening so we can take the proper steps. And one issue that we don't always think about with the results we're getting from the testing results that we see on the day we get them are from the past. They're from a few days ago. And so a lot of times when in public health, when you want to make a difference, it feels like you're overreacting because you're responding to the cases that haven't happened yet. And when you have a spike, you don't know that until days later. So you need to put requests out to the public to self-quarantine, et cetera, ahead of time. And that's why I think for many people, it feels like sometimes we're overreacting and then later we're like, oh no, it really did hit.
Right.
I'm glad we did that.
Dr. Anthony Fauci said, if it looks like you're overreacting, you're doing it right.
That's correct.
That's good to
in public health. I mean, it's hard to prove a zero. Oh, I prevented that. You know, it's harder to see for the public, but I think as long as we know that we still have cases coming in, or we know that we don't know what the landscape of this virus looks like in our state or in our country, we need to be prudent.
And we did these conversations earlier in this week and talked to healthcare providers about what their process was. And we heard from everyone that they needed to prioritize their testing. So people are calling. Mm-hmm. We're hearing from people who are calling with symptoms who are mm-hmm. not able to get a test. And so they're choosing to self-isolate or they're being, you know, requested to self-isolate. But really, mm-hmm. they can't even get the test. So would a massive amount of tests, would an influx of tests, so where everyone could get a test who had symptoms or who had been exposed to someone, who had traveled, or those three criteria that we're hearing about. If you had a massive influx of tests, would that help the problem? Because we would have a clearer pick. We would have more data. Is that how I understand that?
Correct. If we had more tests, we would have more data. To do basic epidemiological assessments, we need to know about the cases and where they are and who has them and who has interacted with whom. We need to track. It's really being a disease detective with no clues. Mm. And if we have a huge influx of tests and a huge influx of people, we do need to be very careful we're not overexposing our healthcare workers. So you still need to call your health professional before you go in for a test, for example, especially if you think you might be infected.
All right. Any other thoughts that you might have about this that we have? Questions to pay attention to? What are those really smart questions that we need to look into in the future here in the coming days?
I think in the coming days, we need to remember to be compassionate. We are hoarding. We are doing the best we can to hold it together while our children aren't in school. People are doing balancing acts of the new schedules and how do I pay the bills. And even if it's not hitting them yet right now in South Dakota, they have family members and friends in other states that this is affecting. So I think we need to remember, you know, to communicate with people as we can virtually. We need to help people not feel so alone and isolated, even as they are in self-quarantine or in isolation. And so really finding that compassion, checking on your neighbors as you can. Obviously, you don't want to expose anyone to potential infection, but it is important to make sure that we don't buy out the store, because there's a timing issue, especially in more densely populated issues with food delivery. We don't want people to not be able to have access to resources they need. Something else I think we really need to think about is adjusting our worldview, especially when it comes to triage. I think that's sort of the new word we need to educate people on. What is triage? Why would it possibly start, and the issues surrounding that word.
That's interesting. I was listening to something on the radio last night, and Governor Cuomo in New York City was saying, you know, these people who are particularly vulnerable with cancer and, you know, heart disease, they're already vulnerable. So we want to take care of them, but keep in mind, and my brother has a 4-year cancer fight, and it just made me so angry because I thought... But then it also made me think more deeply, because I thought you just prioritized him at the bottom and said, you know, he's a goner anyway, is kind of what it came across as. But at the same time, you know, these are the things that we start thinking more broadly about our lives and caring for other people and, you know, the most vulnerable among us. But then also thinking about how can we stay out of the system so people like that can get through. So for all the people who hoarded masks, now my brother can't get his, and that's a real challenge. So people need to think about their behavior as well as their worldview. Yeah,
that's absolutely right. Who's in your community? What can you do, even in small ways, not buying something that you don't absolutely need that someone else might? Because we do have these. We have these very poignant moments when it hits us personally, with your brother, with someone's grandparent or parent, or that we really realize, wow, I have to make a difference here. And those are the situations that we need to pay attention to. We need to wash our hands, even if you're young and healthy, so you are protecting the most vulnerable. Because when we don't want to end up in a situation where we are using words like triage. Right. We need to take our lessons from places like Italy and say, what can we do ahead of time? We are trying to flatten the curve. Will we flatten it enough? We're trying, but we need to, so we don't have the vulnerable in really terrible situations. Mm-hmm. And causing major mental health issues for healthcare workers and the public in general.
Dr. Rocks, I hope you'll come back in the future as we navigate this. This is certainly an ongoing story, and we're hoping we can use you as a public health expert and resource in the future. We really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for helping get the facts out.
Thank you.
some South Dakota companies have struggled with the decision to allow employees to work from home. Others were ready for action before coronavirus had a major impact on their community. John T. Meyer is the owner and CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. He joins us today to talk about helping your employees make the transition, best practices for working from home, and leadership during times of crisis. We spoke with John on Tuesday, March 17. John T., welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. Happy to be here. Good to see you.
So Lemonly made the decision to go remote entirely fairly early in this game. That's something that you were prepared to do, partially because of the kind of business that you are, but partially because you wanted to take a stand early. Tell us a little bit about that decision-making process.
Yeah, you bet. So we do a weekly Wednesday leadership meeting every Wednesday. That's redundant. And last week we sat there and said, look, we started to take survey of the landscape, and, you know, South Dakota, we still were looking okay, but we decided, you know, let's be bold and let's make the move early and show people that we can all figure this out. Other businesses, now granted, as you said earlier, we're fortunate. We do most of our work online. We do have meetings with clients, but those can move to video calls, phone calls. So we understand that's a privilege, and so we recognize that first, but we wanted to say, look, for those of you who probably can do it but haven't tried, consider it. And so we decided to, I think, you know, our policy last week was to everyone, if you're not feeling well, certainly work from home. And I think that just puts a lot more stress and decision-making on the team. And so we finally said, let's set a deadline. We set Monday to yesterday. And that gave everybody a couple days to clean up their desks, take any hardware that they needed to take home, and just kind of mentally prepare. And so as of yesterday, everyone was on a video call, and we did our, you know, we're trying to do business as usual.
Yeah, we had it's not our first Skype meeting, but it was a Skype meeting with a large number of people today. And I remember thinking as we did this, you know, we really are going to keep this kind of thing in the future. So talk a little bit about, as people navigate and learn how to work remotely, we're also taking time to realize that some of these things are things that could be innovations that we implement for best practices in an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I already saw the cartoon, right, that a guy staring at his computer and he said, oh my gosh, I realized that all those meetings could have actually been emails. you know, and so I think some people have said this is going to be sort of remote work is going to have its moment right now. Some out of necessity.
Yeah.
It's going to go great for some companies, and they're going to realize this is something we can do. It's not a scary thing. I actually trust my employees. And it's going to be really hard for others. You know, some companies just weren't prepared or ready. And so I feel, you know, I feel for those organizations, and it's going to be, you know, the remote experience might be very challenging. And so, yeah, I think what I usually say in our world has changed in about a week or two, what I normally tell the companies is just try it. I always say use the E word, which is an experiment. And so whether you say, let's just try one day a week, or let's try the first Thursday of every month, you know, and let employees try it on for size and feel it out, you know, and then what I say to employees then is, go home and, you know, work your butt off, right? Like, be very productive, very organized, be effective, and show your team, your boss, your manager that you can do it. Now, I realize all things have changed, right? Schools are closed, kids are at home, and companies are being thrusted into this, whether they like it or not. And I think that's the hard part. So a few best practices. I always suggest you really need to over-communicate, whether you're using phone calls, conference calls, Slack, whatever it is, you need to be over-communicate. And that's really where it keeps the trust going. It keeps the communication lines open. So, hey, I'm jumping offline to, you know, serve. Even I have my four-year-old here. So
perfect.
She's on the call with me right now.
A great example. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Tell them what you're going. Tell your team what you're doing. And then if you're busy, what? And I'm going to go to work. Thanks, Margo. Sorry about that.
No, I'm not, because that we've had that before where we'll have a radio conversation and somebody's kids or dogs will come in. And I'm like, no, we're setting the example that this is, they're part of our lives right now. They're part of our communities. So hey.
Yeah, this is real, right?
It's real.
I know going through it. And yeah. Honestly, that's the part that's probably, I know how to work from home. Art Lemon, they know how to work from home, but doubling as an employee and as a school teacher has been challenging.
And for a lot of people, not to break this down to a gender role, but a lot of women really struggle with, you know, allowing themselves to, you know, to say, yep, I'm taking care of my kids right now, too. So it's a good example for you to set to just say, this is what we're doing. And this is the new normal for a while, at least. So be super productive and over communicate. What are some other best practices, John?
Yeah, I think, you know, setting the culture and mindset around remote work, I think we get too obsessed with the tools. So thinking about, should we do Zoom? Should we do Skype? Should we do Slack? Should we do, you know, the tools are there and they work. But if the tools will not be a cure-all, right? You need managers, leaders, CEOs need to embrace the idea of remote work. You know, I always like to say, you know, I'll get the question if I give a talk about this topic and what, you know, how do you know your employees are actually working? Well, then I usually say, maybe you shouldn't have, if you don't trust them, you probably shouldn't have hired them in the first place. Right. And so I think that's one of the first things leaders and managers need to let go is trust your people, trust them. If you think you hired the right people, you hired them for a reason, let them work. But also everyone deserves a little bit of grace right now. Right. Things are stressful. There's a lot of uncertainty and it feels like every decision you're making as a leader right now has a 24-hour expiration date. It just seems like the facts keep changing.
Yeah.
You know, first it's no events more than 250 and then it's 50 and now it's 10. These are hard to operate. And so I think everyone also should give leaders grace that, you know, a decision is a decision for now and maybe not etched in stone or new policy. You know, hopefully in a few weeks, we can all get back to our offices.
Yeah, knowing that going in. And you also said in a Facebook post and a video that you posted that you don't know what the future is for Lemony right now. You don't know what the future is for your employees, for yourself. You've still got a brick and mortar space that you have to pay, you know, a lease on, or I'm assuming that, you know, there's still bills to be paid. And even you don't really know the future, but you're stepping into this role as a leader saying, we're figuring out this future together. I thought that was really inspirational. I needed to hear that message at that moment. I don't even work for Lemonly. So
I think what I recommend right now to any business owner, any person, any organization is to really put your customer, your family, put whoever you can first, right? Really give, like, operate from a place of giving. And it's not a sales pitch. It's not a, how can we make money off of this? How can this affect our bottom line? You're exactly right. I don't know what Lemonly looks like in 2 or 6 or 12 months, but I know we're going to get through this and it'll probably look different in some way, but I think our world is going to look different forever after this. And so right now you have the opportunity to really, you know, give first. And I find that, you know, leadership can be lonely, and sometimes I get my own head when I'm by myself. And so if I can be calling people, checking in on people, giving, checking on my team, our customers, and reaching out and just saying, how can we help you? I have nothing to sell you. I just, what do you need right now? Because not only is that the right thing to do, but you actually could, it's a time where you can probably gain a customer for life. Because when we get through this, and we will, on the other end, you know, we're going to have a new way to work and a new way to do business. And those people will remember that you were there for them. You know, so I love seeing restaurants stepping up and saying, hey, this is scary. This is hard, but we'll do delivery. We'll do pickup. We'll, you know, I got a text message from Parker's. That's a place that my wife and I love to go. It said, would you want to order carry out? You know, and this is Parker's, like fine dining restaurant, Sioux Falls. And so the rules of the game have changed, and you need to be able to change with them.
Right. You also say you can just control the things that you can control. And you quoted Frozen in your video. So I really are Frozen too, which is this wonderful message of all you can do is the next right thing. Tell us a little bit about, you know, making, you know, those leadership decisions, which people in the past maybe have thought stand for longer than 24 hours or even 12 hours or 20 minutes, depending on when the next, you know, federal press conference is, right? Understanding that going in and saying all you can do is the next best thing, the next right choice is the choice to make.
Yep. I'm a big believer in a concept called stoicism, which is the idea that you can only control your thoughts and feelings, right? So someone cuts you off on the freeway, you can get mad at them, but who knows what's going on in their life and their world, what type of day they're having. So what you can control is your thoughts and reactions and emotions to that moment. And I think that's something we all could practice a little bit right now, because You know, I've read the articles that say 6-8 weeks, like the interview before months, who knows? And that's, you can get to a dark place when you really start worrying about those things that frankly you have no control over. So what can you do right in front of you, right? If it's going for a walk and getting some fresh air to clear your head, if it's sending a text message or making a phone call to a loved one, just checking in and see how they're doing. That's probably the next right thing that you can do. And for now, that's all we can focus on. And if you can do that and just take it one day at a time, you know, we'll get through this.
John T. Meyer is owner and CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. And I've been tuning into your Facebook video. So more of that, I think, helps people even beyond your own staff with some of those messages. So we appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Thanks for having me, and be well. Take care.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting is committed to our mission of supporting you during the pandemic and every day. Find all our COVID-19 coverage at sdpb.org/COVID. At sdpb.org, you can also find transcripts of most of our COVID conversations and the latest news from the SDPB reporters. Listen to In the Moment live on weekdays at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Josh and producers Steve Zwemke and Chris Loffrey, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.